The next session, Winning Strategies, A View from the Bench, The Verdict. The faculty, Victor Nieblas Pradis, AILA National Past President from the City of Industry, California, Carol King, Immigration Judge from Oakland, California, and Bruce J. Einhorn, Immigration Judge retired from Woodland Hills, California.
Thank you very much, everyone.
You're Carol.
There we go. Good morning. Thank you all for being here. Can't start off by saying Happy Veterans Day to maybe some of our members or family members, so let's not forget this very special day. So we have a great panel and a great topic that we want to really have a conversation with all of you, because as you all know, we're living in very different times as it is right now. I think I've been practicing for quite a while now, and I think this is probably one of the most difficult times to be an immigration attorney, as we're getting bombarded from all angles, not only the new administration, but the attorney general. As you all know, a couple of weeks ago, labeled us dirty immigration lawyers.
Yes.
Nasty women, too.
Stay dirty.
I mean, we could have a panel based on that alone. But certainly, we have a lot of obstacles, and especially when we appear in immigration court with all the different changes that are going on. And what we want to discuss today is how do we handle that? And we have two great panelists here, retired judges, who have been there and who've done that and who've seen the ups and downs of different administrations and different attitudes towards the application of immigration law. And hopefully through this conversation, we can all get a sense of how we can try to approach some of these issues as we go before judges who are stressed out, overworked, understaffed, and what we can do to try to do our job successfully and zealously represent our clients, but at the same time not get our heads bitten off and have contempt complaints filed against us. So in that sense, we're going to have that discussion today. So let me start off with this question, and hopefully Judge King and Judge Einhorn can jump in. What do you think, from your perspective as a former immigration judge, the current environment of immigration judges? What's going on in the immigration courts as you speak to your colleagues?
Well, we've heard about some of it this morning, haven't we? The new goals, particularly the quotas, are of extreme concern. We had this under the Bush administration, this backlog reduction. It puts judges under a tremendous amount of pressure. Any judge who cares about due process is also subject to these goals. As judges were high achievers, were type 1 personalities, we try to do our job the best we can by the agency's standards, but also by our own standards. So when there's a conflict between those two, when you're talking about your standard for upholding due process and the agency's standard for getting as many cases done as possible in the shortest amount of time, it sets up an incredible amount of pressure on judges. So this is of great concern. I want to put a plug in for an Article 1 immigration court, an independent court that's not subject to these things.
Okay, and I agree. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to begin, I grew up next door to Larry David, and I was watching Curb Your Enthusiasm last night, so you'll forgive me, I'm in a certain state of mind. But I'm going to begin with a very blatant comment, and I wrote it in my column in The Hill, which amazingly parented it. We have a president who is a malevolent, bigoted narcissist. He's dangerous on many levels, and he has no qualm about blaming immigrants, both documented and undocumented, for everything from rainy days to crime waves, even though we know that immigrants, including undocumented human beings, commit less crimes per capita than the rest of us, including apparently members of this administration. They also commit less sexual molestation, but we won't get into that either. But I'm going to say it very clearly. You have that kind of a president, and you have an attorney general who's an obsequious little shit. And if there are members of the press here, you may quote me, because I already wrote it. I'm not just saying this to try to be funny. We live in dark times. We have a Homeland Security Department in which the light is on and no one's home. They have an acting secretary. I mean, we should be grateful, I suppose, that there's less direction at DHS, perhaps. But that's the kind of executive branch we have. And we have a Congress that at least is no better. So we're living in dark times. But that's why you are all important. Because you and those judges who are willing to stand up for due process are the ones who turn towards those bad winds and say stop. And while you're going to lose a lot, if you will, remember in baseball, if you hit 350, you're a superstar. So you have to do your best, and I'm sure you will. The real problem is I'm always talking to the cream of the crop when I come to AILA conferences. You know, the scum bucket volume attorneys, well, that's what they are. Never come to these conferences, aren't willing to learn, and have mass production of clients. And that is always a serious problem, but in this day and age, it's a very serious problem. So you've got that. You still have the notario problem. You have to really just do your best and prepare. And you're going to win a lot, and you're going to lose a lot. But your goal should be to stand up for what you believe. The worst thing that will happen to you is that judges will be snippy to you and rule against you. 9.9 times out of 10, you'll walk out of the courtroom a little dazed, a little angry when you lose, but you'll be fine. The problem is the client. So what you have to do is advise your clients for the long haul. To tell them that we're in a circuit that is still decent and humane. I know because I talk to a lot of those judges who complain to me about everything as if there's something I could do about it. But you have to orient them to the long haul. This is very painful and difficult. But the more they push, the more you have to push back. It's not when they go low, we go high. It's when they push, you push back with competence and confidence, and you do the best you can. I mean, it's what your parents told you. You do the best you can.
And let me just say, before we continue, if you have any questions, please go ahead and write them down and send them up here. I'll try to weave them in through the presentation. But, Your Honors, in trying to understand the pressures of immigration judges, and we understand that is an issue. It's been an issue now I've read articles from 2007 when they were talking about the stress levels, the burnout. And in the new administration, we have, or at least we've seen the pressure on travel for immigration judges, whether they're assigned to detail, whether they have to go to a detention center or appear by video conference. What does that do to the psyche of an immigration judge when they have to leave their docket, pick up another docket, travel? Does that change the mood? Did that change your mood when you were maybe assigned to detail?
It's incredibly demoralizing as an immigration judge. To have a busy docket. I had an incredibly busy docket in San Francisco, for instance, with a lot of families with children over the last three, four years. And I was sent to Texas to sit in a male detention facility because of the optics of having every border court full all the time. And that was under the Obama administration. We were at that time ordered to identify 6 weeks a year that we were available to travel, which meant we couldn't have a sick child during that time, we couldn't have a vacation during that time, we couldn't, you know, have a busy docket during that time or anything. We had to identify those weeks and we had to be available. Now, the judges are asked to identify 8 weeks a year that they're not available to travel.
Wow.
You can imagine how demoralizing that is. And they're all being sent to these remote detention facilities where the culture is to get the cases through as quickly as possible. People coming from San Francisco who care very deeply about due process are just coming home shell-shocked from these details. It makes such a difference to a judge that's on detail in one of these places for the pro bono community to be present there, for them to have an ally in protecting due process in these hearings. I can't emphasize enough how much difference it makes to have that ally and that support. They may seem harried to you, they may seem impatient, they may seem, you know, like they don't want you to waste their time. That's very true, but at the same time, they're really glad that you're there because it gives them the support they need to be able to slow the process down and look at every case.
Did you want me to?
Yes. I want you to answer the question, but I also want to add another question, and that is the lack of resources, the lack of clerks, interns. Who writes your written decisions? Did you write your written decisions? Did you have somebody else write them for you? How does that work when we have a lack of resources in the immigration courts?
Well, Judge Tabador used to write my decisions. And she was my law clerk, unless they were too conservative. But she would help. But it was very hard because I was sharing the law clerks with other judges. And the other judges generally gave the law clerks motions to reopen, hundreds of motions to reopen. Now, the good motions to reopen usually are pretty clear when you start reading them. And so are the bad ones. So I always took the position, I don't need the law clerks to do that. I need the law clerks to help me with, for example, the LA 8 cases. I had some Palestinian cases which I dismissed. I needed help with that. So the problem, though, is you're sharing everything. And you're sharing it with judges who may have different priorities as to how to work. As to the administrative staff, it was a disaster when I was a judge. And it's worse of a disaster now. And frankly, if the administration, any administration, wants the court to move more efficiently, you have to remember that the people who grease the wheels are the administrative staff employees. And so, you know, if AILA or any other group wants to do something, it should be petitioned for more of them in a non-ideological way. Of course, you may have a philosophical view because if you have a better administrative staff, you're more likely to get fuller and more meaningful decisions, which probably means more enlightened decisions, but you really should push for that. Now, as to the judges, let me make this very quick. I have great respect and affection for 90% of my colleagues. They work under enormous conditions. It's like combat. Mm-hmm. And because of the bad lawyers, because of the travel, because of the volume, they really have a tough time trying to feel like judges. There are two kinds of judges to begin with. There are immigration experts who find themselves judges and judges who do immigration work. And the judges who do immigration work are always the ones you want to come before me. I never worked for INS, which is no criticism of those who did. I never worked for DHS. I was a Justice Department prosecutor of human rights violations, so I had a different bent. But I do know that those are the two kind of judges. If you add the pressure of a workload, you may be turning all those judges into judges who just don't feel judicial, because when you're demoralized, the robe means nothing. What if you go to these detention areas, what you should be doing is saying the things, you know, indirectly perhaps, that the judges can't say, which is, Your Honor, I prepared a brief. I know how busy you are. My own view is I know how unfair this is. I want to do this so that there's less chatter in the courtroom and give you a chance to review it. Perhaps you could take a few minutes or something. You've made your record, but you've also told the judge, yeah, I get it. I know. The other problem, of course, is that more and more judges, at least many judges, keep looking behind them or over their shoulder to see what the higher-ups want. I never did that. It wasn't quite as bad, but I also came from Washington. I knew where the bodies were buried. And but it is very literally, and but it was very difficult. I once ordered the government to bring back someone they had deported by mistake. And another, I gave them the weekend to bring him back. And one of the other judges came in and said, you shouldn't be doing this. You're going to get in a lot of trouble. And I said, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble? I didn't deport the guy by mistake. Well, they brought him back. Nothing happened. But what you have to do is reinforce to the judge the idea that you respect the court, that you appreciate the judge, and bite your tongue if it's a judge about whom you have mixed notions. Because the more you accord the judge an understanding of her predicament, the better you'll have a fair hearing for your client.
Yeah. Matt, let's talk a little bit about some of the specifics. By and large, in most of the immigration courts, judges share by four judges to a law clerk. So we get about a quarter of a law clerk's time. We're expected to be on the bench 36 hours per week. So we have 4 hours to deal with motions, preparing cases, research, keeping up with law, training, filling out all kinds of government forms that we have to fill out every year, you know. It is a monumental effort to try to get done and be the level of judge that we all want to be with 4 hours of prep time a week. Now, there's several people in this room who've been my law clerks. They are amazing, fabulous people. They work really hard. We appreciate every little quarter of a person that we get, but it's not enough. So that is really, truly an area, legal research is truly an area of low resource that we really need higher resources for at the court.
Which is why you have to prepare your cases in a painstaking way, and I know it's hard because you have to practice law for a living, but you really have to do that so that you take some heat off the judge. By the way, it's always been the case that EOIR openly discourages written decisions, openly, and lets the judges know it. So they don't like putting cases on reserve. So just understand that.
And one of the issues to consider at the national level, I know they've asked AILA whether or not AILA would support the hiring of new judges, resources for judges. And so there has been a discussion in reviewing the levels of private attorneys who are being hired as immigration attorneys, which is almost none. Most of the new hirees come from either the government work or straight from DHS. For years, I know that I've been raising this with the EOIR in our liaison meetings, and the constant answer that we get is, well, it takes 2 years to go through background checks, and so government workers have already gone through those checks, and it's faster. And my response is, well, that worked when you told us that 6 years ago. And obviously we're still not seeing that level of private attorneys being hired, and maybe for mirroring the conditions, that's probably why. But I do know that people are applying, yet these positions are not being filled by private attorneys. But understanding the pressures of the judges, so let's now go to the actual immigration court. And when an attorney is preparing a case, how can a private attorney approach a situation where the immigration judge is concerned about case completion goals or might be impatient, had a bad morning or afternoon, but it's at the expense of your client's due process rights? What does an attorney do? How can they approach a situation of this nature? Anybody?
Well, I mean, I think it's really important to remember that the fact that the judge is under all this pressure, the fact that the judge is harried or you know, crazed by what they're asking him or her to do or whatever, doesn't mean that you don't have to zealously represent your client. It doesn't mean that due process shouldn't be served. It's not an excuse. It's something to keep in mind, and like Judge Einhorn said, it's really important to let the judge know that you understand the pressures they're under and to hold a line at the same time. So you just have to say, Judge, we need to stop here. We need to slow down. This is what I need to get into the record. And you're talking about several different kinds of situations. You're talking about maybe having a judge who's very committed to due process, but also at the same time who's trying to get as many cases done as possible, who's trying to reduce their own stress. We carried caseloads of about, on average, 1,500 or more open cases when I was at the court. I think it's going to go up exponentially now. That was under an administration that was actually drawing priorities for the first time. This is going back to the bad old days when Judge Einhorn was on the bench before I was. When I first started, you know, this was the kind of attitude that we saw on a regular basis. And it's just very, very familiar to me because it's what I saw when I was practicing from ICE. And a lot of judges just sort of, okay, I'm running so fast, you know. You just have to ask the judge politely, respectfully, to stop and look at your case. If it's a run-of-the-mill case and you can go through removability quickly, great. You know, don't make a big deal about it. But if there's a reason to stop at any point in the process, whether it's a defective NTA, whether it's a defective arrest, whether it's, you know, a novel theory that you have about the case, about removability or about relief, it's just a matter of respectfully asking the process to slow down so you can make your argument. And if the judge won't slow down, making a record anyway. You know, making sure that you're letting the judge know, this is what I want to do. This is my offer of proof. Won't let you make an offer of proof. Judge, let the record reflect that you're not allowing me to make an offer of proof. And then move on. Remember that there's a difference between arguing before a judge and arguing with a judge. It's not your job to, in open court, convince the judge that he or she agrees with you. If it's clear that judge is not accepting your argument, your job is to make a record for the, because if it is a novel argument, it's not going to be decided at that level. It's going to be decided by a higher court.
It just reminds me, I don't know how many of you have seen the musical 1776, but in all the votes, my home state of New York abstains, and every time the delegate abstains, he goes, New York abstains courteously. So I get courtesy is a big deal. You want the judge to understand that even though you might have to push the envelope, even though you might have to make an objection, that you understand the judge's position, because it won't always work, but I know judges who, if you say things to them that make them understand, might respond by going, yeah, I thank you, but, you know, we still have to be fair on this issue. Well, you know, that's something. You have to know your judge. I mean, most of you, I'm sure, have practiced before many judges. But for those of you who are scheduled to be in front of a judge before whom you've never appeared, you need to observe that judge. I mean, for every two judges in L.A. or San Francisco, there are five points of view. And that was a pretty funny line. But that's literally true. I know that was true in L.A. And while that's great fun when the judges get around at lunch and, you know, debate each other, it's not as much fun for you. So you need to understand not just the views of judges, but the demeanor of judges. And try, without violating your oath as a member of the board, to accommodate that style. You don't have to accommodate the views, but that style. Second thing is you have to be prepared. I understand how hard it is. Prepare, prepare, prepare. There will be things in the courtroom that will happen that you could not possibly imagine. Like the client who says, did I tell you about the two children I had with this other person? And it's like, no, you didn't. And the judge goes, take 10 minutes and figure this out. That's going to happen. But by the same token, the more you prepare, the better the judge will understand. Even if the judge says, I don't have time to read it. Well, you filed a brief. File things on time. Forget about complaining about the operating instructions or procedural rules. Just follow them. Because some judges are really anal about that. And other judges will simply appreciate it. So that's another issue. But you have to make your record. It just doesn't matter. You can be polite, but you must make your record. And if the judge gives you a hard time, just take a deep breath and say, I appreciate your remarks, Your Honor, but I must respectfully object or reserve on this issue. It's all you can do. And if some ICE attorneys are excellent, but if the ICE attorney starts, getting into something or else, you might want to pick one or two spots. And my final comment is, don't argue about everything. Not in court. Don't argue about everything. You have to pick your spots. Because if you argue about everything, the judge will get the impression that you don't believe in anything.
But you like to hear yourself talk.
Right. Which judges, of course, find no problem. But try to pick your spots. It's very, very important that you do that. It's a hard job. I respect you guys. And that's pretty much what I got to say.
One of my favorite sayings when I approach one of these situations, we have a judge who's upset or stressed out. I always say, I understand the court's position, Your Honor, but I have to make my record. Mm-hmm. And I just keep repeating that over and over. I understand the court's position, but I have to make my record. As to your comment, I do remember a piece of advice that I received from a former colleague, Judge Ojeda, who told me as a young attorney, keep your eye on the prize. You don't have to win every battle. You have to win that prize at the end. And it does make sense in the era that we're living in, simply because we're seeing a lot more arrests. That hasn't translated into hundreds and thousands of cases being filed with the immigration court. At some point, that will happen. But I assume that because of the arrests and because of some of the abuses that have been reported in the media as to how these arrests are coming about, we're going to start seeing people challenge those arrests, NTAs, alienage, motions to suppress. How did you, both of you, see these motions? Because it's always been my experience that judges are reluctant to hear motions to suppress, or, they're like, oh, yeah, they're denying alienage. Okay, it's a waste of time. How did you see these challenges?
Well, first of all, when you're in a system that hears death penalty cases in a traffic court setting, you get into ruts, okay? There's no doubt about it. You get into kind of, okay, this is what the cases look like. This is how I can cope. This is how I can survive in this system. And I immigration attorneys get into, oh, every case looks alike. We're filling out the same forms. We're doing the same things. And everything starts to look the same. And when something different comes up, sometimes the first reaction is, oh, no. you don't want to see that because it stops your rhythm. But that's just the first reaction. By and large, the judges, the colleagues that I had, at least in San Francisco and pretty much all over the country, we're lawyers. We like the intellectual stimulation. We love to hear novel arguments. We like to cogitate over how the law might be developed. We like to be involved in that. So it's hard to make that happen in the day-to-day work that we do. So you're giving a judge a gift if you bring a novel argument, if you bring a motion to suppress, on some level, you're giving that judge an opportunity for intellectual stimulation. So, but you're also a pain in the butt. Okay, so that's the balance. And I think it's important to remember that you don't want to do this just for the heck of it. If you're making a novel argument, if you're bringing a motion to suppress, you want to have a reason for it. Is it necessary to your case? You know, you really want to look at that. If it's not necessary, probably don't bother. You know, don't do it just because it makes you feel smart or you saw something that you, you know, want everybody to see that you saw or whatever. I mean, if you want to do that, bring it up. Say, Judge, you know, I could contest this NTA because this arrest was really not so good, but this is a really strong asylum case, so I'm going to go ahead and admit removability and let's go on to the asylum case. That way you show that you understand, like Judge Einhorn was saying, the pressure that the judge is under, and that you're going to take your best shot, not just every shot. We're in a day and age, and this is, like I said, the way it was when I was practicing, we're in a day and age where the ICE attorneys are going to contest every issue all the time. It is entirely inefficient. It is going to cause the system to implode. The system was imploding several years back, and we got prosecutorial discretion. We got the ability for judges to administratively close cases over the objection of one of the parties. We got some tools that helped us keep the system just barely with its nose above water for a little while. But this system is going down under this administration. There is no doubt about it. You cannot sustain what they're asking the system to do. So, you know, you just have to do your best, hold the line, when you have something like a motion to suppress, make sure you prepare it really, really well. Make sure it's absolutely relevant to your case. It's not just sort of a theory that you think is kind of cool, and that you're ready to do more work on it rather than less. We see all the time attorneys with novel arguments that they think are really cool, and they make them instead of preparing their case, you know, and that a judge is not going to listen to, and it's not going to look good on the record either. So make sure that you've done the preparation. Go to your colleagues and say, what do you think about this? Poke holes in it for me. You know, ask people to look at it. Make sure you can plug the holes before you present it. And make sure that you're not wasting the judge's time. Instead, you're offering the judge an opportunity to do something new and different.
I'm not going to repeat Judge King because I agree with everything she said, so let me add a few things. You have to understand my position. I clerked for the D.C. Court of Appeals. I came from an Article III background, most of my litigation experience. So, you know, when I came to the Immigration Court as a judge, I realized I was dealing with most judges and most government attorneys who had a very different worldview. There was no discovery, you know, they as you said, you know, they objected to everything, something you can't do, et cetera, et cetera. But the worst thing was you couldn't get the ICE attorney to speak privately to the defense counsel, I call them defense counsel, before the hearing. You couldn't get, you know, when I used to go before a district judge, we'd have a discovery conference, the judge would say, yeah, I see you have 10 issues. Could you limit them, you know, work together, limit them to 2 or 3? Which meant you will limit them to 2 or 3. This doesn't happen because of the volume and because of the lack of formal discovery. But if you try, and you should follow it up in writing, to meet with an ICE counsel to resolve issues of removability that are minor, you know, in a worldview, but important to your client, and you don't get a response, admit the letter into evidence. The judge may not care, but the Ninth Circuit will care. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if you have to go that far. Trust me, that will matter. Also, don't be like the ICE attorney. Don't object to everything. If the ICE attorney gets personal, don't get personal back. Always look at and argue to the judge. Yeah. Never argue directly with the ICE attorney. It's hopeless anyway. Unless you have a very decent ICE attorney, in which case you're not getting objections to everything. And the ICE attorney, my ex-law clerks, of course, will give you a few minutes, you know, could we have a recess? So that, all of that is very, very, very important. I wish I had more practical solutions for you, but you really have to pick your spots, stay calm, and focus in. But I will say one thing lastly. If you have to contest removability, you damn well better do it.
Yep.
Because it may irk the ICE attorney that you have the nerve to question notices to appeal, which are written in a third-grade style, which are templates, and which are just horrendous. You shouldn't critique.
They're not even done by attorneys anymore.
I know. I don't want to get started. ICE is the only agency that has litigative support, lawyers, where the lawyers don't write and sign the complaints. Can you imagine if Bob Mueller gave all this to an ICE agent and go, well, see which indictment you want to sign? I mean, can you? Yeah, I could imagine that. Not with him. I work for him, but someone else. But you understand what I'm saying. If you have to, you do it. Because if they blow their top on the record, let them blow their top. Yeah. If the judge says, do you really have to do this, your response is, I sent a letter to the government attorney, but now I have to force them to bear the burden of proof. I didn't want to be here. One real final thing, always let your client know what's happening. Mm-hmm. You don't want your client sitting there and going, what's going on? I understand it's hard. You got to inform the client.
Especially if the judge is going to yell at you,
right,
because that scares the heck out of clients.
Right. You just say, he's yelling at me.
Yeah. Yeah. And in an environment where ICE is contesting every single issue, if you don't do that, you end up looking very good.
Amen.
Yeah.
A question that we received from the audience. What is one of the most annoying things that an attorney did or does, thinking that they're helping their case or their client, but they're really hurting their case?
Oh, boy, the list is really long.
We only have 20 more minutes.
Okay, well, you know, we've been talking about making novel arguments and that sort of thing. So there's an attorney who every time he contests the NTA in some way, he's telegraphing that he has a really crappy asylum or cancellation case. You know, it's just like clockwork. It happens every single time. So, and usually his challenges to the NTA are kind of bogus. It's fine if you know, obviously I'm asking you to not do it unless it's necessary. So, but at the same time, you know, make sure you really have a reason to challenge the NTA. Don't just do it because, you know, the rest of your case is crap. So there's that. There's an attorney who writes lovely literary briefs with all kinds of references and, you know, but never any legal research. You know, never, it's just sort of like, oh, look, this situation is like what happened in The Tempest and Shakespeare. You know, I was like, that gets tiring after a while.
What does he think he is, Judge Kaczynski?
yeah, kind of.
He's a good friend of mine. Anyway, he's the only judge who wrote a decision in verse. But I agree with everything that was said. The main problem, and this happens with less experienced attorneys, it never used to anger me, but it would, you know, exhaust everyone in the courtroom, is instead of making a bullet point argument, when you have a good one, you go on and on. What you're doing is you're editorializing against the system. Most judges, they understand the system sucks. It's just they don't need to hear it again. You need to hit the bullseye as much as you can. I had a lawyer in my courtroom who once made a motion which was superb, and I granted it, and she just went off. And I said, all you can do is win. I mean, you have to really do the bullet point. Also, if you do that, you might say something you regret. If you don't let it get personal. That's what I hated. When lawyers would start fighting with each other, you know, it was like that song from my youth, Children Behave. Well, you're all younger than I am. So keep it to the point. Don't get personal. Don't use histrionics. And allow the judge to ask questions. Then you can go on.
And if you're young, don't be ageist. Can I ask that? I can't tell you how many young attorneys would come into my courtroom thinking they knew a hell of a lot more than I did. Maybe they did. Maybe they were a lot smarter than me. But I'd been around the playground a few times, you know, with immigration law. And really, it's insulting. And it doesn't get you very far with the judge.
I helped draft the asylum law and back in the Lincoln administration. I would have young attorneys come in, not knowing that, it's no big deal, and would say, Your Honor, I need to instruct you on what the law means. And I'd sit there and go, oh, go ahead. You know, like, as opposed to, Your Honor, could I make an argument about this discrete issue in the law? Which is, you know, terrific. Right. So you want to come into the court and have the judge think, oh, I'm so glad she's here.
Right. And I see a lot of faces in this room that I thought that about a lot when I was on the bench. So
before we run out of time, I do want to pose this question because I think it really we need to address it. When we have a situation as private attorneys, practitioners, whether a judge is just, you know, out of control, has been out of control now for several hearings, and you feel as though your only avenue is to file a motion to recuse. And you file that motion to recuse, people are afraid to file motions to recuse. They feel that maybe you're going to be retaliated in the future or other cases or that particular case. What are your views on motions to recuse, and if you have any insights as to how judges receive them?
Well, it's never easy getting a motion to recuse. I would say consider very carefully whether or not to file a motion to recuse. Don't move to recuse just because you're angry with the judge or you disagree with the judge. Just because the judge is angry with you. Don't do it on the spot. Take some time to think about it. Don't do it even just because the judge seems hostile to your position or your argument. Instead, make your record. Again, these novel arguments are going to be decided above that level. If the judge is being hostile towards it, it's going to show in the record. You're going to have a better appeal with that judge than you would with a judge who treats you very well and still denies your argument, right? So consider very carefully. Motions to recuse should be used in cases where there's demonstrable bias, not just disagreement with a particular argument. So if a judge is making comments against a class of people that your client belongs to or something like that, then you have a record for a motion to recuse. And then absolutely, and you can't worry about future consequences because you really have to deal with that situation. But, I mean, I've recused myself where it turned out a friend of the respondent showed up in court and was a friend of mine, you know, and I just, you know, she's sitting in the courtroom, I might have to deny this case. I just started feeling like, I mean, I asked the parties, I revealed it, I said, you know, do you want me to recuse? They both said no, and then I went back in my chambers and I went, am I really going to want to deny this case in front of my friend? And I'm like, I just don't feel right about it, you know, and I recused myself. So, And that was a hard one because I'd gone halfway through the case before she showed up at a second hearing. So I was having to turn over a case to another judge that was halfway done, and that's always very awkward and difficult. But I just felt I had to do it. You know, so I really think it's better to make a record if you can, if the hostility is over an issue as opposed to hostility towards your client. And sometimes it's hard to tell, but unless it's demonstrable on the record, I would say you are taking a big risk by doing that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, if you look at the federal statute regarding administrative and Article III judges and grounds for recusal, you won't find very much of anything. But the general rule is that recusal should be obtained when there is evidence of extrajudicial bias or the actuality or appearance of bias in the context of whatever there is a given issue. And Judge King is right. It usually means toward a client, not towards an argument. It should be a last resort. It should be something that you don't use as a threat to a judge. And it should be something that you have to balance against other factors. I mean, is it worth it? I understand you may have a legal basis for it, but as a practical matter, is it worth it? Could I make this point nicely in the context of the hearing rather than make a motion, which will stick, in the judge's craw, even if she grants it? And of course, you know, in 5 minutes, every judge in the city will know what you've done. Mm-hmm. So you have to, because every judge who hears that a colleague's been subject to such a motion immediately puts on the armor waiting for the motion, which is silly sometimes. Let me a last point. Well, 2 points. You have an ethical obligation to make the motion if there are grounds, but you also have an ethical obligation not to make the motion if it's just a tactic. And finally, although hearsay is admissible in an immigration court proceeding, you should not use it in a motion to recuse, a la, Your Honor, we've heard that in a lot of cases you have this prejudice.
Right.
You have to show that in the context of your hearing, your case, that there has been one of those breaches. I understand you may hear a lot of things, but that's not why we had a judge, a lawyer once, who's been disbarred, actually. So keep that in mind. He made a motion before Judge Fong at the very beginning asking for him to recuse himself because it was a Chinese asylum case and, quote, everybody knows Your Honor hates Chinese people. And Judge Fong is, of course, part Chinese American. Well, he denied the motion, and every judge in the city really was trying to request permission to crucify that lawyer first. Now, since the lawyer was disbarred and an idiot, it's not something you would do, but you get my point. You have to balance these factors. And we have 10 minutes.
And you know,
to balance these factors.
Just to add to that a little bit, if there is a situation where a judge is consistently hostile towards a particular group of people, okay, as a group, you have to deal with that. So what you need to do is you need to start pooling your information. You need to make sure that you document every single time that happens, and then as a group, maybe you start doing motions to recuse in every case, and you all band together and do it. And then that judge can't really retaliate because you're banding together, you know, and there's more than one. And then somebody up the line is going to take notice of that. So, I mean, really, you want to be very careful about these things. And you know, you don't want to let stuff go that shouldn't be let go. But you also don't want to overreact.
How do you handle or any suggestions on trying to create a record of bias of you know, maybe in like this question says, favoritism towards the trial attorneys? I mean, that's something that I think as private attorneys sometimes irks us when we go into the courtroom. We're not there every day, at least some of us. And the trial attorneys there, and they have like almost a personal relationship with a judge, and you almost feel as though there is some favoritism or some bias in that relationship. How do you handle such a situation? Is it even warranted?
Before I took the bench, I had a very serious mistrust of all trial attorneys. That the law firm that I grew up in taught me that, and I was terrified they were always trying to undermine me. When I got on the bench, I developed a much more balanced view. I realized that a lot of the trial attorneys for ICE were really trying to do their job the best they could. They were open to listening to people's stories. They were open to stipulation and everything else. They're really good lawyers and good people. When I was practicing, they were terrified of the person who ran that office in San Francisco. And they literally were not allowed to use the S word, stipulation. They weren't allowed to use it. They could sort of wink and nod and say, well, I'm not going to object if you go here, you know. But if their boss heard about that, boy, were they in trouble. And I'm getting the feeling that it's going to be that way again. Okay? So you got to remember they're under a lot of pressure too. When you see somebody in your courtroom over and over, day in and day out, yes, you develop a working relationship with that person. There's no doubt about it. But my friends were all from this organization, you know. So there's, you know, it's a very difficult thing. You want to be able to work well with the people who are in front of you all the time, you know. And you want to be able to work well with the people who come occasionally also as a judge. So I think lots of times what you see in terms of like banter or whatever, it's probably inappropriate. The judge probably shouldn't be doing it, but it's a natural sort of way of having a reasonable work situation, you know, a way of feeling like you're having a relational work situation. You're in that courtroom 36 hours a week. You know, it's hell on wheels if you don't develop relationships with the people who come before you. So, I think you want to be careful about what you think you're seeing. If the decisions are all going that way, then that's another matter. But if all you're seeing is kind of like a friendly banter, and it doesn't happen with you as much because you don't know that judge as well, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Is it still the case that ICE attorneys are assigned to particular judges?
Yes.
Okay, that, of course, creates the conditions.
Exactly.
When I had an ICE attorney who I really liked, I worked with all the time, and he or she would sort of go over the top, I'd go, oh, come on, counsel. So in a way that, you know, all right, you're right. You know, it's, or I'll just... I will record your objection. But, you know, not all judges will do that. What you want to do is try to make a record that what you object to is ICE's policy of never agreeing to grants of cancellation, notwithstanding the respect you have, suck it up, for this attorney. Because what you're telling the ICE attorney is, I know it's a systematic problem. Don't worry about it. I'm just making my record. Because I would have ICE attorneys who would say to me, Judge, I can only stipulate to one cancellation like every 8 weeks or so. And she goes, she would pause and go, I know it's ridiculous. I said, look, I don't want to get you fired. And I certainly don't want to get you transferred to Florence because I need you here. So... But that's a problem. On the other hand, attack the policy and the institution. Let the ICE attorney know that this is not personal and that you get it. The governor and the judge will understand.
And seriously, if I was interacting with an ICE attorney that made the respondent's attorney feel uncomfortable? I would want to know that. It would be okay with me for you to come up after the hearing and say, Judge, this made me uncomfortable. You know, I know you're trying to be fair, but this didn't feel fair. You know, I would need to know that. So I think, you know, obviously you got to judge who it is that you're talking to, what judge you're talking to. But if you have a judge who you think takes a relatively balanced view decisionally, but it feels like they're favoring, just in terms of their interactions, favoring the ICE attorney, I think they probably want to know about that.
I had a very good defense counsel whose water broke in court.
Oh, jeez.
It happens. I mean, it happens. And the government attorney objects. And I said, well, I'm sure that defense counsel joins in the objection, but we're going to recess and help her get to USC Hospital and, you know, overruled. I mean, I didn't know what to say. And later the ICE attorney said I was just discombobulated. I said, okay. I said, but, you know, it shit happens, you know. But you get my point. Try to be known.
We have about a minute and a half
true
left.
True story.
One last question here, and I apologize to the questions that I could not reach. Some judges, in presenting their cases, either if the attorney is not doing a good job, either take over the questioning, are very thorough in jumping in there and asking the questions. Others do not, and just let the case fall flat. Is that a personal approach? Is that something that's taught? Is that something that's instructed anywhere in your trainings?
I think it's more of a personal approach than anything. I do remember being told in some trainings that it could get you in trouble with the circuit court. But on the other hand, you know, the judge also has an obligation to build the record and make sure the record is complete. And sometimes you just don't get any help from the attorneys. So I actually was one who would jump in. I don't have the best memory for, you know, I tend to be very involved in the case as it goes along. So to try to remember my questions for the end in case they don't get covered doesn't work for me very well. So I would frequently jump in and just ask a follow-up question or whatever if I saw that things were moving on and something wasn't getting covered. But other people don't do that. I think it is kind of a personal preference. There's pros and cons on both sides. The bottom line is you have the primary obligation to make that record, and, you know, you better ask as everything that you think the judge is going to want to know.
That's true.
So,
any final comments?
Yeah, very, very quickly. The regulations allow for judges to do that. As a general rule, the better you prepare and the more you draw out, the less that's going to happen. As long as the judge doesn't start cross-examining
right. In
tone, don't make a big deal of it. It might actually help you. If the judge becomes, you know, the inquisitor general, then you're going to have to very gently suggest that you object.
Well, I'd like to thank the great wisdom on this panel, Judge King and Judge Einhorn.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you in court. Thank you very much.
Not me.
Not me.
The CLE
so nice
code 0408-0408.